Okay, so maybe it's an American thing, perhaps a Western thing, but there is this idea, this conceit, that in all the world, somewhere, out there, there exists a perfect person for you. And your job, if you choose to accept it, is to find that individual, the one that somehow completes the unmatched puzzle piece that is you. Most people never accomplish this quest. Of course, they give up, things happen, they settle, life moves on. But for a lucky few, fate intervenes. Light breaks from the heavens, the galloping steed slows down, and from the mist steps the perfect match. Well, given that this is the season for lovers, we wondered how things really go down the instant after the fog clears. From WNYC, Snap Judgment proudly presents The Perfect Match. Amazing stories from the aftermath. My name is Glenn. I don't want to be a player no more, Washington. And you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now then, if you've ever wondered what it would be like to be trapped on a desert island with only one other person for a year, well, Snappers, that's why you listen to our show. We take you there. We do these things so you don't have to. Snap Judgment.
I was working as a clerk, or I think you may say clerk, for the tax department. And every lunchtime, I sat in a library looking at maps and newspapers for inspiration. But this particular advert, which was in a London magazine called Time Out, appealed to the moment I read it. It went like this. Writer seeks wife for year on tropical island. And the word wife was put in quote marks, which told me it didn't really mean wife. I wasn't anywhere near ready to settle down and become an ordinary member of civilization. And when I saw that advert, I just thought, oh, yes, that could be it. That could just be absolutely right for me. The man who placed the advert was Gerald Kingsland. So I phoned this chap that I knew nothing about from one of those old-fashioned red British phone booths. We met for a drink in a London hotel. And I noted at once his suitably Robinson Crusoe-ish red beard. He asked a good question. If I could take a very few things, what would I take to an island nobody'd ever lived on before? And I said string, because string, fibre, any kind of thing that you can tie things with is just always useful. He thought string was a very good idea. Gerald outlined the parameters for the venture very simply. He just said a year on a remote tropical island with no contact with civilization. He did say that he had other girls to interview, but he would get back to me soon. And he did. It turned out that this particular island came under the jurisdiction of the Queensland government, then under the control of a very extreme politician. He said that in order to go and live on an uninhabited island where only goannas and turtles and birds would see what we got up to, we would have to actually get married and have a marriage certificate. And finally I just thought, okay. I mean, it's a piece of paper. It's just a piece of paper. But part of me obviously didn't think that, because we stood there in a little registry office with no friends, proper friends there, or, you know, no cake, God's sake. I cried my eyes out on the night of my wedding. We did. We made an agreement before going through this rather absurd joke of a marriage ceremony. We made an agreement that after the year, he wouldn't hold me to the marriage at all, that I was just free to go. I think he was quite hurt, but I so clearly didn't want to marry him. He'd always wanted to go with a girl to a desert island, so, you know, there was in him a hope that there just might be the possibility of love from this relationship. Can I talk about arriving at the island? Arriving at Toon Island for the first time, we were in a motorised canoe, which was manned by indigenous islanders of the Torres Strait. It was a bit like out of a film. I mean, that part of it was a bit like out of a film. It was so classic desert island. We were bouncing over these little wavelets in a blue sea there with ahead of us this island we were going to live on for a whole year. Palm trees waving, white sand, sun blazing down. But when we actually got there, and there's a sort of crunch as the boat lands on the beach there, and then it was just all practical stuff. We had some things we had to unload. We'd taken just the very minimal supplies that Gerald had suggested right at the beginning. Seeds to grow, that was very important. Emergency water bottles, very important, but really a very small amount of what you might call groceries to keep us going until those seeds sprouted. Had a little bit of rice, some porridge oats, and of course tea bags. There were larger things like the tent that Gerald had provided. There was an axe, a bucket. I did take off my clothes pretty well straight away. Didn't see much point in keeping them on, and we were hot. And he did the same, I mean, after a little while. And it rather impressed me that an old man like that would be so uninhibited. Gerald started getting the tent up, and I thought, well, is that the ground sheet? It was very small. When he'd got it up, he stood back proudly and said, well, there we are. And I put my head in and I thought, oh my God, that is tiny. He just went to sleep and I lay awake for ages, just loving being there and thinking of what we were going to do in the morning. Well, in the beginning, we had those minimal stores. We'd go out, we'd walk through the shallows to get to a good spot for fishing, climb onto a big rock, so that we weren't got by the sharks that would come in pretty quickly as soon as we threw out any bait with blood on. When we went fishing, we both got coral cuts on our legs, but mine healed, his didn't. And again, this was from quite early on. And these cuts that he got in his legs began to turn into holes, and they just got deeper and deeper. These were serious coral ulcers, and they caused him an awful lot of pain. I was expecting, of course, that this leader, this man, this older, wiser, more experienced person would be going out of camp every day, exploring, cutting down wood to make a shelter, dragging in great logs to make a wood pile. The bottom line was, I was full of energy and enthusiasm. I wanted to get things done, and I thought that he would want to get things done. And he was kind of the opposite. I got fed up of him not doing any wood chopping. I would start to go fishing by myself, and I'd come back and he'd be lying in the same position on a very, very old green towel, the only towel that he took to the island, in the same position as when I'd left camp. At the beginning, I just thought, oh, well, you know, he's going to start doing stuff soon. One of these days he's gonna get up and say, right, this is the day we're going to start building the shelter, Lou. But when I realised that this saying, oh, we'll do it tomorrow, was going to go on, my respect for him went down. It became clearer and clearer as the days went on how different we were in our approaches to the island. I just loved it, and I was beginning to, in a sense, lead a completely different life during the days. I'd go off early in the morning and I'd explore, I'd listen to the birds, I'd follow turtle tracks, I'd find flying foxes hanging in the trees. And it was something I kept from Gerald. It was very private. I didn't tell him about my favourite rock, where I lay. And I felt, in fact, very, very sensual. And I'd come back from there, humming a tune, maybe, really happy, glowing. And he'd say, God, you think you'd had a lover on the other side of that island. You really would. He had a point, because I had fallen in love with the island. Although it sounds all very Blue Lagoon, this falling in love with the island, Tuin was in fact quite a hostile little island. It wasn't a beautiful tropical paradise at all. I think I, in a sense, chose to fall in love with it. It was a survival tactic. Always been a fairly optimistic person. And if I was going to be stuck on this island for a year with this man with whom I was getting further and further apart the whole time, I had to find a way of enjoying it. And by having this sensual relationship that I did with the island, I did find a way of enjoying it. I loved it. And there he was, poor Gerald. I mean, he was just more and more unresponsive, to my enthusiasm. And more sunk into what we could unkindly call it apathy, but, you know, I really think it was a genuine kind of depression. But the pain in his legs, and maybe the pain in his heart as well, affected him very, very badly. I was the lucky one. I was the one who fell in love with the island. Later, he told me he fell in love with me in a way that he didn't really expect to. So during the days, I lived in my other little world, loving it. And we were civilized with one another over our little meals, but trapped at night, I mean, inches apart in that tiny tent for 12 sweaty hours at a stretch. Now, that was a different story. And it was impossible to escape what was happening between us. There was resentment, probably, on both sides. There was unfulfilled lust. We had the disappointment in each other. I didn't always disguise, as I might have more kindly done, how I felt about him not getting up and being more manly. Our relationship really fell into what I called a black nadir. It couldn't have got much worse. He called me every single name under the sun. If we'd been in civilization, I'd have packed my bags and left. But we couldn't. At night then, I mean, we just curled away from each other as far as we possibly could in the tight space of that tent. And it was scary. And he could have strangled me in his anger, and no one would have known that I hadn't been caught by a shark if my body disappeared. I thought of leaving Gerald often. I never thought of leaving the island. Well, we wouldn't have been mad enough to go to an uninhabited island that definitely had no water. I mean, nobody would be that mad. But then if you think about it, if an island has been uninhabited, nobody really knows what the water situation is like. We rigged up a water catchment system because we were aware of a possible shortage of water on this island. And we began rationing our tiny little supplies quite early on. We were having a cupful of water twice a day at one point, and just that it's not enough. I mean, it was seriously hot there. A lot of that water would have come from rainfall, and time again, we'd see clouds go over and raining on other islands, but not on our island. And that became something very troubling. So, and not moving, that to me was the worst part. Having to conserve energy. Because by then, I'd stopped feeling energetic. I'd stopped feeling like a wonderful golden creature on a desert island, having a terrific time and feeling high. I was a skinny old woman at the age of 25. Both Gerald and I knew, although we didn't talk about it, very British of us, that if something good didn't happen soon, like a good rainfall, we could die. This island would be the death of us. It was a bad scenario. very bad scenario. All the hostilities that had been between us were in fact very, very petty when this much bigger problem came as something that we had to face together, the shortage of water. Gerald would say from his supine position on the green towel, he'd say, "Might rain today, Lou. Might rain today, Lou." And I'd say, yeah, might. It could rain today. Gerald looked at me once. He said, "I looked at you, Lou. I looked at you, you know, with your little shriveled veins sticking out of your legs like an old woman, like grapes they were. And I thought you were going to die. I thought this woman's going to die and it's my fault." Gerald at that time was very down. He was just about crippled by the coral ulcers in his legs, and that was so demeaning for a man who'd been very proud of his physique and how strong he was. I mean, it was just horrible for him. And he lay in camp day after day on this horrible old green towel. And I remember one day when I came across him like that, I sat down on a rock and just looked out over the sea, and it was a beautiful day. And maybe I had a moment of very strong nostalgia, because I sang a ballad about wild mountain time in Scotland. One night when we were just lying awake and hoping for the sound of rain, that sound came. And that was a very, very special moment indeed. It must have been, because Gerald and I didn't very often hug at that stage. We turned to each other and we just said, "Rain, rain," and hugged. And it was quite a euphoric moment. Although we had a lot of bad words between us, I did realise that Gerald was very hurt by my having much more of a warm relationship with the island than I had with him. It was unfair. I can see that. Eventually, towards the end of the year, we were rescued. I mean, there's no two ways about this. And if the islanders of the Torres Strait hadn't happened by Tuyn Island one day when I was fishing skinny as a toast rack on a rock and come to see what on earth was happening to with these crazy white people, I might not be here talking to you today. They came and immediately saw what the problem was. Not enough food, not enough water. And basically, they sorted us out. What happened then was that Gerald became very useful to the islanders because it turned out that he was a very skilled mechanic, and their main means of earning a living was crayfishing from little motorized canoes, and their engines were forever going wrong. They wanted to take him to their island and for him to live there with them. But I did not want our island year on Tuyn to end. We set off with the idea of staying for 1 year on this island, and we were going to do it, or I was going to do it, even if Gerald wasn't going to do it. The islanders from Bardu Island would come and collect Gerald and take him off to work on engines on their island. I knew that Gerald was being pulled away, that another lifestyle was offering itself to him by these people who revered him for his skills. And my respect for him absolutely shot up when I realised he was so good at this particular skill. I was also watching this man transform. First of all, he was getting his physique back. He was now eating better. They would bring flour, and I would make little Scottish scones and things on the open fire. And he loved that. He loved that kind of food. But he was also getting his own self-respect back. He was doing something he knew really well how to do. I mean, I was just seeing a different man emerge. And I thought, well, maybe this is the moment to get us together physically. And why not? I mean, I made a deliberate decision. One day he'd come back from the island and I would
I'd be ready to give him a nice evening. And so it happened. And in fact, it was fun. And we did it again and again and again. So, yeah. And he became very appealing and sweet to me as a man. Perhaps inevitably, there came a time towards the end of the year when and the chief of Badu had offered for him to come and live with the islanders on Badu Island and be a chief mechanic. Gerald made it very clear that he wanted me to be a proper wife and stay with him, maybe even have a child with him, and that he'd like us to make a life together there on Badu. He wanted us to stay together. He wanted the marriage that had been such a forced affair in the beginning. He wanted that marriage to be real now, and I didn't. I was going to leave. There wasn't a particularly poignant parting with Gerald. It was factual. It was, well, goodbye then, from my part. And bye, Lou, from his part. He just got on with some work, and I think he just needed to do that. We can't choose who we fall in love with, and I didn't fall in love with him. I fell in love with the island. And I got into a tiny, tiny little two-seater plane, and we flew over the island, so I was able to see every part of the island's body, if you like, that I'd explored in detail over that year. And that was a very poignant moment indeed for me. It was just this other woman, a patient travelling to hospital, behind me, the only other person on the plane apart from the pilot. And she saw me crying and she just said, "Oh, small island, funny kind place." Ah, she just summed it up perfectly for me.
Friends, believe me when I tell you there is so much more to the Lucy Irvine story than what we were able to fit in here. You can find a link to her three truly fantastic books, Castaway, Faraway, and Runaway, on our website, snapjudgment.org. And don't worry about Gerald. He found another wife in the Torres Straits Islands. They lived happily for a long, long time. As for Lucy, she got married, had kids, and eventually moved with those kids to another deserted island. Today, you'll never believe it, but Lucy is living in a caravan in rural Bulgaria, where she runs an animal rescue organization. Find a link as well to that remarkable work on our website, snapjudgment.org. Original sound design for that piece by Leon Morimoto, and the story was produced by Anna Sussman. When Snap Judgment returns, the best date ever. And the monkey god. For real. In just a moment, Snap Judgment, the perfect match episode. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the perfect match episode. Now, our next story goes to show that if you have something to tell someone, tell them now. KULW reporter Liz Jones takes it from here.
My friend Ben, he's known he was gay since about the seventh grade. And he says although he came out to almost everyone in his life early on, he put off telling his parents for a long time.
So growing up, there were always times that my mom would ask me, "So when are you going to get married?" I mean, I would never know when it was coming, but it would come up all the time. Just, "When are you going to get married? When are you going to have kids? Do you have a girlfriend yet?" And I would just try to change the subject, you know, saying, "I only want to talk about it."
This is actually from an interview I conducted with Ben 9 years ago. So you have to remember that back then, there was no gay marriage. That still seemed like a long way off. And Ben, he just didn't want to break his mom's heart. He'd planned to tell his parents in college, but then his mom's health took a bad turn. She developed a brain aneurysm, went blind for 6 months, had heart trouble, and needed a pacemaker. It just never seemed like the right time.
you know, so another year would go by and another year would go by. It was getting to be ridiculous, like, because I was in my 30s at this point, and I just wasn't that kind of person. Like, I think it was a disappointment in myself. It's like, gosh, you just have to do it. You just have to get it over with and not have this hanging over your head.
Finally, one New Year's, he was at his parents' house, hanging out with his mom in the kitchen, and she asked the same question that she always asked.
She's just asking me, you know, Junior, when are you going to get married? And so finally, I was just like, you know what, I'm just going to tell him. So I, you know, I said, Mom, I'm never going to get married because I'm gay. And she starts laughing at first. She goes, oh, very funny. You're not gay. And I'm like, Mom, I'm gay. Then, you know, she just gets this really perplexed look, almost like kind of pissed at me, maybe. Like, and then so we kind of got into this little, you know, not quite a fight, but just more of an argument. And I could just see her disappointment. But I definitely felt a big weight off my shoulders on my list of huge things I needed to accomplish in my life. That was a huge check mark that I was able to take off to finally come out to my parents and to be completely out.
After that, although Ben's dad was fairly accepting, his mom just didn't really talk about it. But Ben figured that's okay. He'd done his part, and now she was processing.
I guess it was about a year and a half later. My sister had gotten engaged, and we were at an engagement party. And, you know, at that point, my mom looks at me, and she's like, when are you going to get married? At first, I was like, oh, she's joking. I'm like, come on, Mom. You know, I'm not going to get married. And then she's like, why? Like, what do you mean? And I'm like, Mom, I'm gay. And you know this. Then I saw that little look on her face turn to more like confusion. Like, you're gay? I was like, oh my God, she does not remember. She had some short-term memory issues, but I was like, there's just no way that she can't remember this about me. And it was just that whole feeling, a little bit of shame came out again. And so it was a bit of a shock that I had to go through it again.
So after the second time, do you feel like now she finally gets it?
I think at that point I was just like, you know, I'm going to just have to remind her again, and this will become part of her memory now. But I think in the back of my head, I just could tell by the way she was looking at me, the way she was talking about it, that she still maybe did not grasp it 100%.
6 months pass, and it's another New Year. Ben and his family are at the Buddhist temple, where they go every New Year's Day to chant their resolutions.
And it's this whole group of probably 500 people or so chanting over and over. And then my mom, just sitting there, she's like, when are you going to get married? And I was like, oh, no, not right now. And she is like, you just need to find the right girl. I'm going to chant for you. And I'm like, I'm going to chant that you understand.
That night, Ben went to his sister, his dad, and had kind of an emergency family gathering. There must be a way, they figured, to get his mom to remember.
So that's why we came up with this game plan for my dad to talk about. Like, my sister told my dad, I want you to, every night before you go to bed, just say, Junior's gay, which we thought was really funny because we didn't know if he would do it or not. And when we were just imagining my mom and my dad laying there in their bed and like saying, good night, Junior's gay. But just to try to, maybe it would sink into her subconscious while she was sleeping. So we had all these plans. We're like, we just need to talk about it more. You know, like, you come home when you go visit them, say, hey, mommy, dad, I'm gay.
But it turned out the fourth time wasn't the one that would make her finally understand. Neither was the fifth or the sixth.
He got to the point where it was just comical because the same scenario has happened time and time again. She would ask in the morning, maybe at breakfast, and then it wasn't unlikely for it to happen again in the afternoon. Like, Mom, we just talked about it this morning. It's like, what did we say?
Wait, so how many times has this happened?
Oh, at this point, I don't even know. I mean, my brother has a 3-year-old son. We just had the birthday at some big chain restaurant, and we're sitting there with all these kids, And I could just see the look in her eye that it's coming, because she starts looking at me, looking at the kids. So I'm trying to talk about everything and anything else other than marriage. And, you know, we're making it through the birthday cake. And there she goes. There she is. When are you going to get married?
So are you feeling like she can't get it because of her memory problems, or because she doesn't want to get it?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there must be this emotional block. There's a part of her that just doesn't really want to believe it. Even though she sees me as a happy person every day, she thinks in my life, I probably truly can't be happy unless I'm married, you know, to a woman and I just have this family. So the novelty of it has worn off, definitely, whereas before it was, you know, it's gone, run the gamut of frustration to anger to sadness to just being a hilarious story that it would tell, to now it's just, I'm just tired of talking about it, kind of. Now it's like, Mom, come on. You know, at this point, you have to know. It's been 10 times or it's been 15 times that we've had this conversation, and I know you must know. And when I was younger, I was almost angry at her for deserting. Like, I was like, where's my real mom? I'm like, gosh, my old mom would give me a hug and say she understood and, you know, support me with it. But now you don't understand.
Ben told me that because of this, sometimes he found it easier to not come out at all, to stay in the closet, at least for that day.
Sometimes it would be when we were, you know, at the hospital when my dad was, you know, going through chemo from his cancer, and she would bring it up, you know, with all her sincerity. And it was, I didn't want to hear it because it was like horrible timing. It would be like, yeah, Mom, yep, I'm going to get married, have a baby, and head off the question as soon as I could.
However this may sound, Ben and his mom are really close. They have this great connection.
Please, we need a third checker.
I went with them one day to the supermarket. They joke around a lot as they're shopping. Ben's mom leans on his arm as she walks.
Can you carry that?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Sitting in the car afterwards, Ben mentions his sister's pregnancy. We both look at his mom and wait. We knew he was setting her up. Without missing a beat, she turns to him and says she wants him to get married.
That's so nice.
Ben's my friend, and I've heard him imitate his mom saying this dozens of times at parties. But watching it happen, it just seems sad. He patiently explains while his mom shakes her head, and after a while, she starts to cry a little. She stares out the window, away from him. He slaps her on the leg.
Why are you eating me? You want to make me cry? Just be back to normal.
It is. It's my normal.
That's not normal.
Well, everyone has their own normal, Mom. It's not the same, but you always told me to be proud of our differences. It's not like, see, I mean, you know, it's not like I've chosen. There's no way that anyone would choose this. You know that. To choose it, to have your parents not want to accept you, you know? Why would you choose that? There's no reason, right? All right? No, now a kiss. Thank you. I've actually had dreams of my mom before she was sick. You know, it's not necessarily like we're talking about this subject, but I mean, in one dream that I've had, I was with a boyfriend and she was driving us somewhere in our old Chevy Malibu that we had. It was great. We were just like driving. I don't even know we were driving to Kmart or somewhere where we used to always go as kids. But I just remember being with this guy that I don't remember what he looked like. I wish I did. And she was just driving, just talking like everything was normal. Fine. It was no big deal. And she would know, you know, my son's gay. And I could skip all this trouble of having to come out numerous, endless times.
When I first interviewed Ben, I wondered if this was it for him, this kind of one-act play with his mom, a play that would never close. But like I said, that was 9 years ago. And recently, I got a chance to catch up with both of them at her house in Seattle.
Are you ready to eat?
Eat's my favorite.
That's right. You're always up for a meal, right?
All the time.
That second guy you hear, that's Paul. He's Ben's partner. They met right after our first interview. And this is their weekly family dinner with Ben's mom.
I make pickles, borscht, and lasagna.
One time. Right.
Ben's father passed away a few years ago, and his mom is a lot slower than she used to be. But looking at Paul sitting at the table, laughing and joking with her, it's almost like this is what crumbled her memory block. Having Paul around all the time as a friendly reminder that her son is gay, she gets it.
And so we've been together now for 8 years. My mom really cares for him as well, thinks he's a great guy, you know, hug and kiss every time she sees him.
We just did a birthday dinner for Ben.
47.
Mamma mia, 47. For me, only she's 15 years old.
Yeah. Over the time, she would still say, you need to find a wife. And she would still say it. And I'd be like, Mom, I have Paul. In the first couple years. But just recently, I'd say in the last year or two, it turned from when are you going to get married to only when are you going to give me a mago? When are you going to give me a grandchild, a baby? And when I finally said, Mom, you know that I'm with Paul. She was like, I know, but you could still have a mago.
Big love from Snap. We hope everything works out. Now, the sound design for that piece was by Renzo Gorio, original sound design. And that story is produced by Liz Jones in partnership with our good friends at KUOW. Now, 9 years ago, Liz originally edited that tape together with Sarah Koenig when Sarah worked at This American Life. It took a while, but we're glad it finally came out. When Snap Judgment returns, I get to tell a very, very, very personal story to 3,000 of my closest friends. And the Perfect Match episode continues. Stay tuned. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Perfect Match episode. My name is Ben Washington, and now we're going to magic you away. The Brooklyn Academy of Music, Snap Judgment, live.
Now then, I was with my girlfriend, Rini. What she didn't know was that I had a wedding ring in my pocket. It was her birthday, and she liked stuff to seize into the future, tea leaves and meditative stuff and all these things that I didn't believe in. But she said, what did you get me? What'd you get me? What'd you get me? What'd you get me? Hold on. I got you an appointment to see the number one Vedic astrologer in the country. It starts in 40 minutes. You are the best boyfriend ever. I am. And she's going on about what she's gonna ask, what she's gonna ask. She likes to see the future, see something into the distance. And I don't know what she's saying because in my head, I've got this Marathi script going. I'm trying to memorize to ask her parents for her hand in marriage. Mia, Adarpranada, Yanana, Mia, Adarpranada, Yanana, and I'm trying to do this thing. See, Marathi is a language from Western India. And it turns out that there's lots of Marathis. And I was studying the wrong one for 3 weeks. But I finally got it right. There's a book in the back of the University of Michigan grad library, and I translated everything out. What's going over? Mia, Adarpranada. Yup, Lapa, can't get it right. Doing the best I can. And I'm doing this because Rini's parents are old school. They don't play this switching castes, switching communities, switching cultures. They were introduced to each other by a matchmaker 2 weeks before they got married. They consulted the stars, they consulted the elders, they consulted the charts, and decided they would get married at 3:30 in the morning, a.m. on a Tuesday, because that was the most auspicious date to provide for a happy community and a happy marriage. Now, they're not gonna have some random black dude come messing up with 2,000 years of culture, or as her cousin called me, that black bastard. But this is America. America, love comes first. So I take her to see the astrologer, little brown woman with a bindi on her forehead, and she's like, "Glenn, she's so pretty, you didn't tell me that. He's been calling me every day for months. Is this gonna be a couple's appointment?" "Y'all do your spooky fortune teller stuff by yourself. I'll be back in an hour." And I take off, and I'm getting that script in my head, Mia, Dada Panaka, Yanana, Mia, Dada Panaka, Yanana, and I'm thinking about the first time that we started hanging out. We were first study partners. And she said, "You know, if we're gonna kick it, you gotta learn something about my culture." I went to her spot, and there is this figurine on a table with a monkey's head. "What's that?" "That's Hanumanji. It's a god of love and devotion." And she said it in a way that I should be paying attention, so I started paying attention. And then she went into a closet and she got out this long drum with a head on both ends, and she straddled it. And she started it with this beat, this boom, dong, 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 dong. And I swear to God, it was the most erotic thing I had ever seen. Things are about to get imminent. I didn't say that. What I said was, "Hey, if we're gonna kick it, you gotta learn about my culture too. At least what's left of it." My culture comes through food. So I fixed her a plate of my grandmother's collard greens with red beans and rice, and I watched as she ate it, and she was enjoying every bite. "Oh my God, Glenn, this is so good. This is so good. And you made him vegetarian." Yep. Such a liar. But she ate every bite anyway. And she got up, and she came, and she sat down next to me, and she put her head on my shoulder, and I felt like I won a cosmic lottery. Lucky. I'm thinking all this, and my hour has already gone past, and I get back to the astrologer's place, and Rini's trembling. The astrologer lady, she won't even look at me. "What happened? Let's go." I take Rini outside. What'd she say about me? "You know I love you, right?" That's what she said. What's the problem? "Sometimes, Glenn, love is not enough." And I'm like, I'm feeling this weight of this culture and this language and these things and these people and Hanuman and stuff. I'm like, "Darling, you're making something simple into something hard." It was a couple weeks later, we're walking in a park, and she says, "We can't do this anymore. Because of astrology, because of who I am. This is not something you can join. And when she ran away crying, I didn't take it sitting down. I kept that ring and I thought, you know what? This gets me a little bit more time to get my mariachi right. Mia, Darbarnaka, Yanara. And I kept practicing until I got a call from her cousin who told me that Rini went to India. And that was code for Rini got engaged to someone else. And I just remember falling. I can't recall even the next few days, but I heard she got back to town and had set a wedding date. And friends, mutual friends, started flying in. Some of them thought they were attending my wedding now. And I was at my table, at my desk, trying to get my mind right, reading, writing, doing something, and I hear her walk towards my door. I hear her come right up against my door frame. I hear her put her head against my door. I listen as she waits. And then knocks really, really softly when she walked away. And I let her go because I knew even then she would never let this happen. This was not gonna go down. Until it did. She took another man's ring. I heard she was a beautiful bride. I took my ring to the astrologer's house, up and down one side of her car. Right? Wonder if she foretold that. And a long while went by, and I was exactly where I was not supposed to be, in a dive bar, when I met her. Not her, her. This woman who I knew I was going to marry, like I was seeing my own future. I went home and told that very thing to my roommate. I'm getting married to the woman I met today. And I did. And it's been easy like Sunday morning. Two big head kids, love, all that stuff. And it was just last year when, in search of other people's stories, I went to India. In India, flew into New Delhi. But India was cool with this crush of people, the little kids, the street food, and the music, and the dance, and I was having a fantastic time. But in the middle of New Delhi is this six-story temple to Hanuman, which I did not want to go to. I had to go to. And I started walking through this temple, and it's beautiful. These pictures, these frescoes, these scrolls. And at one point, it's like I can see through one of the pictures. I am transfixed. I don't even know what's happening. And this temple master, he comes up to me and he says, "Would you like me to explain some of these pictures that you see?" I said, "Ganesha, Krishna, Parvati, that's Hanuman carrying the mountain. You seem a little bitter." And so I told him the same story I'm telling you. And he listened. We sat there and he listened. And he said, "Glenn, if everything you knew, your God, your family, your belief, your culture, if you had to trade it all for a promise, would you do it? Or would you make the same decision that this Reenie made? I thought about it. And I realized I would.
Snap judgment. New York, we are so happy to be here. Thank you for this welcome.
The original score for that piece was composed by Alex Mandel. It was performed by Alex and the Snap Players, David Brandt and Tim Frick. Share the film version of this story with someone you care about. Available right now at snapjudgment.org. And if you're anywhere near beautiful downtown Oakland, we're putting on a brand new live show featuring the closer James Judd, Josh Healy, and more. Saturday, February 27th. Get tickets at snapjudgment.org. Now, it's about that time. Don't worry. If you missed a moment or need more stories to share with your lover, we've got just a thing. Subscribe to the Snap Judgment Podcast Player. It's for lovers. Hit us on the Facebook, the Twitter. Snap was created by the team that moonlights over at The Quiet Storm. Finger snaps for Mr. Sexy himself, the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. Papacini Miller. Anna Sussman, Davey Kemp, Joe Rosenberg, Nancy Lopez, Renzo Gorio, our Get Down crew, Anna Adlerstein, Liza Spiff, Matt Ducat, and Leon Morimoto. Jasmine Aguilera has her own fan club. Much love to the CPB. Now, this is not the news. No way it's the news. In fact, you start spitting your smooth game on the fly ladies at the club, only to discover that you don't have any game. Those aren't ladies, and this isn't a club. Even then, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNY.